Good morning. So, last time we finished up talking about DNS, and we mentioned, this idea that we can have DNS servers that are responsible for mostly querying other DNS servers, which we call recursive resolvers, typically. And we had DNS servers that are primarily responsible for storing information about one DNS zone, which we call authoritative servers. And typically, a server is one or the other, though there's nothing actually preventing you from having a server do both. We mentioned, we want to talk about how DNS actually kind of works on the network. DNS, the standard actually specifies kind of a presentation format, a format for humans and configuration files, and the actual format that's sent over the network. And something you can see throughout all of DNS's design is that they were really concerned about being compact. And probably why they were really concerned about being compact is that DNS was kind of designed to be primarily sent over UDP with a very small packet size limit. They wanted to have 512 bytes, and that like really made you think carefully about how do I not waste too many bytes. And for DNS performance-wise, so one performance thing they did is like keep all the records very small. Another performance thing DNS does is this caching idea, and we'll see this again actually when we talk about HTTP. That DNS does a lot of work to enable efficient caching because we don't want a DNS server for, a very sort of highly queried site like google.com to actually get a query every single time someone accesses it, both because that's going to make that really hard to provision that server and because it's going to, make it pretty slow because we have these extra steps to access it every time. So we want to avoid that by caching things. And this is especially important because the root servers get a lot of traffic already, and this is with a lot of caching. Most of the stuff they're sending out is cached, pretty aggressively everywhere. Then we went over kind of our DNS record types and formats. We're gonna go over a few extra ones today. So we saw we had kind of our standard ideas of addresses with are represented with whose names had various numbers of A's depending on the size of the address. We saw we had this idea of having these aliases with CNAME for canonical name. And we saw we had records to say what was authoritative for with NS records. And we saw we had a type of record for identifying particular services called SRV, where the idea is that like you'd have a name for the service, but the server doesn't have to be Virginia.edu for the Virginia.edu version of email, or we saw the example of LDAP. We learned that these weren't used very much, basically because they were introduced too late, and there's not great sort of infrastructure for them. And we saw text records, which we saw were kind of a wild west of, if I want to store something in DNS and I don't have an obvious way to do it, I'll just use a text record. I'm not gonna get a new record type approved and standardized, just gonna use a text record. We mentioned that when we have a DNS zone, typically we're gonna have multiple servers, so one of them will be a primary, one of them will be secondary, and several of them will be secondary, and DNS is designed to kind of support this inherently in that the DNS protocol has ways for the secondary servers to sync with the primary servers. Where basically we make a special query, which is like, don't just give me, google.com, give me all the google.com records. There's a way of doing that for the secondary servers. And we finally talked about how we can send DNS over TCP, UDP, etc., which, the over TCP part, is something you'll do very briefly for the homework that's due this week. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so looking at the quiz, I probably should go over question two, because it seems like there was confusion about why in the scenario in the question, we couldn't have a path between network D to C to F. And the central problem here is that the relationship, or was it D to C to F? Sorry, it was F to D to C, yeah. From F to D to C. Yeah. And the central problem here is that if we're thinking of our transfer of money, this is our transfer of money. So network D is paying network C for a service. And if we allow this path, and our kind of network F and D have a peering relationship. So they're not sort of paying each other. The reason they have a connection is kind of to shortcut paying someone else to connect them. Right, that's why they're doing it. They're not connected in order to provide a service to each other, because no one is sort of paying for internet services to each other. So this routing doesn't make sense. D is not going to offer this service because basically D is paying for the privilege of helping network F get connected to the internet. And that's not consistent with the idea that they're just peering. Questions on the answer? I should draw the arrow in the grid direction. Okay. So I'm going to finish up some things about DNS. So, so one thing that you can do in DNS is that you can look up IP addresses to DNS names. You might say, how does that work? Because we can't know what, we can't just know the IP address goes to, virginia.edu from the IP address easily. And the answer is that we have kind of a separate domain hierarchy for IPv4 addresses. It's under inadder.arpa, and we have a new record type called PTR pointer that specifies that. So we basically encode the IP address as a name under this special inadder.arpa, and that gives us the record. And the idea is that the people running the DNS zone for 143.128.inadder.arpa should be UVA. This gets a little tricky when we have a network that's, not a /16 or a /24, so it's not like divided up evenly on the quads. We have to rely on someone like setting up a DNS server that might be shared between multiple networks for this to work properly. And sometimes it doesn't work properly. But this is kind of the idea of how reverse lookups work. And note that, just like we can have multiple addresses for a single name, we can have multiple names for a single address, and we'll commonly see this if you do reverse lookups. So nom.virginia.edu has this IP address. It also has this maybe less memorable name. And there's also, this is also supported for IPv6 with just a different format under IPv6.arpa. Where, again, note that they're dividing the name in both of these cases to make the zone hierarchy match. Like, they're taking the front of the name and putting it at the back of the domain name. And one other thing with domain names is that there are what is called internationalized domain names. So, for example, the above is something you can copy and paste into your web browser and it will work. And you might say, gosh, okay, so that means that domain names support Unicode, right? Domain servers have the support for not just my normal English ASCII characters. And the answer is no, they don't. This is all kind of implemented on top of normal domain name support, where they've just decided that you're not going to put two dashes in a normal domain name. So we'll use two dashes in a name prefixed by this xn to represent this encoding called CUNY code for that's standardized for this ED code. And that's how it actually gets represented in the DNS protocol. And I would say, like, my impression is empirically the deployment of internationalized domain names is a lot less than people were hoping for, even in areas where it seems like it would be fairly straightforward, like Greece has an alphabet that is, they're used to typing, you know. You'd think they'd use them a lot, and they don't. And it also has one which doesn't have the problems of, you know, East Asian languages of having a lot of characters, right? It has a very, you know, compact character set. So that's, you know, but this is supported, like, hope for. And IDN names have, like, some special considerations when you're considering, if you're running a registry. So remember, the registries are the people who, like, maintain the list of names under .com or .edu and so on. And this is what's so-called homograph attacks. So if we're allowing sort of all the characters for all the languages, there are things that look like, characters that look alike that are different characters. So for example, this is how my font renders B, a Cyrillic letter A, and ankofamerica.com. And we probably don't want that to be a valid URL that you could accidentally have in your URL bar, and you say, oh, I have Bank of America's website. Because it is literally impossible to tell if you're looking at a screen displaying that. Even though it's a completely different, from DNS's perspective, domain name. So you might say, what do we do about this? And none of the solutions are the DNS protocol, because DNS just sees this weird name, that's fine. They're kind of all things that the registry has to do, or the browsers, or other things that display domain names need to do. And at registries, what they do, what they've at least done more recently, wasn't done originally on .com, famously. I think the example someone did was they did PayPal with that A. As a demo, like, maybe we shouldn't allow this. But registries, like, that are paying attention to this will restrict, will carefully look at the names they register, and they'll both look to see if it's, like, looks identical to existing domains, which is actually, like, pretty annoying to do, right? You have to have a table of what characters look like what other characters. Or they'll just disallow mixed scripts. So often they'll have a rule that your domain name has to be, if your domain name has Cyrillic characters, it needs to be all Cyrillic characters. Your label, sorry. Like, so because they allow, like, .com, but the label, you know, which is, remember, one of the things between the two dots, would need to be all Cyrillic characters. And the other thing is browsers have restricted the display of this sort of internationalized form and display the XN dash dash form, except when they have kind of a list of when it's okay, or some, like, rules for when they know it should be okay. When they know there's no sort of confusingly similar name, or they have some top-level domain names like .gr and .jp that they know, like, have very careful rules to prevent these sort of issues that they actually enforce. Note that I didn't list com. So questions about internationalized domain names? And one thing I originally had slides for, which we might cover later, but I'd like to mention exists, is if you looked at the DNS protocol, you might notice that there's no actual verification that the records came from the right place. And this is especially concerning with UDP, where it's just one packet. If you as an attacker can make your own version of a packet with, like, the wrong IP address, you could convince someone that that's the response to the request, even though it's not. Like, you could beat the real response if you sent it over a network, over, you know, some network where you could just send packets from the wrong IP, from a forged IP address. And remember, the IP address is just bits in the packet. If it's not filtered, you could just do that. And this is really bad because of recursive resolvers. So recursive resolvers, remember, cache responses. So if you could get, you know, Comcast resolver to cache a different google.com, that could, or, you know, different, maybe better example, different mail.google.com or, you know, or Gmail, you know, that would be pretty bad. So we might talk about kind of what you do about, what we can do about this. The answers, like, aren't as great as you'd think, but obviously this is something that you have to actually be concerned about when you deploy DNS, is how do I make sure, you know, an attacker can't convince me to cache a bad response. And the other reason why it's bad is that if you're forging a response, you could have the wrong TTL time to live in there. You can have a time to live of like 2 weeks for your fake domain. So even if, like, this takes a while for you to do, you have plenty of time to get the payoff. Yeah. So I'm going to move on to our next topic. We're going to talk about sort of sockets. And to kind of introduce sockets, I want to talk about kind of identifying individual firmware. So sockets are kind of our way of letting applications have a file that they can use to access networks. It's the sort of main interface used for doing that. Not the only possible interface, but the main one people actually use, and the one, you know, you're going to probably end up using if you do network programming where you write stuff that uses TCP or UDP directly. And when we're doing this, well, we have multiple programs on a machine. We need to identify them. And the IP address isn't enough, so we add these port numbers. And TCP and UDP and most protocols that run on top of IP add a 16-bit port number, you know. And the analogy that I have borrowing this slide from CSO2 is, like, you can think of them as like PO boxes at one address. And there's some conventions about how these port numbers are used. In the protocol, we're just going to send a number. So, like, the machine could technically do different things, but people have kind of agreed that the lower port numbers, usually 0 to about 49,000, are going to be assigned to particular services. And there's a special reason why the lower 1,000 or so are considered very special, which is historically, and on many systems still, the, you know, port numbers below 1,024 have been reserved for the system administrator. So you can't log into Portal, for example, and run a server on port 443. Like, it will just say permission denied. You can't do that. Because that's reserved for the system administrator to set up. But generally, all the numbers below 49,000 are kind of, the idea is that you're going to, this is, the port number is likely to be assigned by a human, is like usually what happens. And where that boundary is varies between OSs. So it might be lower, it might be higher in a particular system, but somewhere around there. And the upper port numbers are allocated on demand. And this is because if I'm like connecting my web browser to a web server, I still need a port number. Even though, you know, no one's connecting to that port number, but I need a port number for the web server to send stuff back to the browser. And the operating system will just assign a port number whenever you need one, and if you didn't specify, it's probably going to choose from these higher numbers to do that. And as I mentioned, these port numbers are going to be associated with sockets. So sockets are the files applications use to access networks. And like with normal files, you can have many sort of open sockets at once. Just like you can have many files open at once. So you probably, if you're accessing the network, you need to have at least one open. Just like if you're accessing files on disk, if you're accessing the disk, you probably need at least one file open. but you can have many open at once, so they're not like, so even though I said the port number identifies the application, it really identifies a socket. And it's actually more specific than that. So in most OSs, they'll identify a socket with what's so-called a 5-tuple. So we have our protocol, a source IP address, a destination IP address, a source port, and a destination port. And these 5 NUT values can identify different sockets. And they can identify different sockets even if, you know, only one of them differs. So one application could have, so we could technically have one application, you know, which has a, we could have two sockets which only differ by the destination address. So we could have one socket to port to 10.0.0.2 and 1.10.0.3, and they have the same port numbers. That's fine. That is a thing we are allowed to do. OSs probably usually, you know, won't do that too often, but you know, that is a thing that is perfectly permissible. We can have two sockets to the same destination IP and destination port with different sources, and they could be considered different sockets, or the other way around with the same source ID and source port. You know. And we can have two sockets which have the same IP addresses and port numbers but different protocols. So a TCP socket for a particular port is completely independent of the UDP sockets for that port. And this is sometimes confusing because protocols like DNS that support TCP and UDP typically use the same port numbers in each. That's just a convention. There's nothing which says those port numbers are actually related to each other. It's just that we've decided to use the same number in both places. It's not that there's some actual thing that ties TCP and UDP together like that. Yeah?
If a socket, let's say, it has the same like source IP, that's, like everything's the same except for the protocols, Can two programs, well, like if a program has like it has that certain port number assigned to it, can it read every socket that is like related to that port number?
Can it, if a program has that port number assigned to it, can it read every socket that's related to that port number? No. It only when you create a socket, you're gonna get this assigned. We'll talk about exactly how you do that. There's calls you make to like, so obviously when you initially create a socket, like this might not be assigned yet. But once it gets assigned, like that's what you're associated with your socket. So we can have sockets that are associated with multiple source addresses and multiple destination addresses. The way that's going to work is that we'll have kind of a special wildcard value for the destination or end or source IP to represent that case. And that wildcard will match any destination or source. And this comes up for like a web server, right? Where a web server, for example, when someone's connecting to a web server, we want to accept connections from any other IP. So we'll have this 5-tuple still, but we'll kind of have a socket that kind of matches everything for accepting new connections. And then as we'll learn, when we accept a connection, we'll create a new socket that's specific to that, you know, specific remote IP. That answer your question? But yeah, so, but because of this, you know, if you have a socket that has this specifically, you don't learn, it's another program that shares the port numbers, you don't get to see. Yeah, so, and as I mentioned here, is that the destination IP and port can be a wildcard, and I guess also the source IP and port can be a wildcard. I should have that on the slide. And usually, I guess the destination IP, I should have this more specific. So the destination IP and port can be a wild card, and the source IP can be a wild card. Not the source port. But you can have a non-specific source IP, meaning that I'll accept connections on any of the IP addresses that belong to this machine. And maybe I should say this, I should call this local and remote instead of source and dest. Okay, so I mentioned UDP, and we said UDP has port numbers. UDP has the simplest header of anyone we've seen. There it is. Source, destination port, length, and checksum. Okay, so we're going to talk about, you have these sockets, we're going to talk about the socket interface. And the sockets that pretty much everyone uses come out of the Berkeley standard distribution of Unix. So people have either like have code that actually derives from the original BSD code or have copied the interface diligently. And this was originally a C-based interface. I'm going to show us mostly the Python interface for this. And it's pretty much the default interface for programming TCP connections and UDP connections across every platform you can think of. Like, it's not the only interface that's out there, but it's what, it's the native interface on Windows, OS X, probably even classic Mac OS, and Unix, Linux, probably embedded systems even. Yeah, it's very ubiquitous. It's not, even though it's not the only possible interface for this. And some things that will show up when we're using sockets, the BSD sockets, is that BSD sockets were designed when there wasn't a clear winner for what protocols are we going to use for our networks. So BSD sockets support more than just IPv6 and IPv4. They are kind of designed to support lots of protocols. So in practice, we would probably only use IPv4 and IPv6 support, but the interface shows in a lot of places that they really want to support all the possible protocols that are out there with one common interface. And also, we have one interface for kind of two very different abstractions. So we mentioned when we talked about TCP, that TCP provides this stream abstraction, that we have a bunch of bytes we're sending together. And that's different than kind of our low-level packet abstraction of datagrams, where we send, a datagram and it comes all together, it has a size, different datagrams might be reordered, whereas a stream, we always get one byte, then the next byte, then the next byte. No matter how what actually happens on the network, sockets is going to use the same interface for both streams and datagrams, the same API. But obviously, some of the functions are going to end up doing slightly different things depending on whether we're using streams and datagrams. So let's start with kind of our simplest case, which is going to be UDP. And we're going to do this. So, and I'm going to show the Python API rather than the C API because the Python API has less cruft. I'll show one or two examples of the C API, but the difference is mostly that specifying addresses in the C API is more complicated. That's about it. So I'm going to mostly use the Python API because, the function in C, for example, is called socket and bind and send to. That's the name of the functions in C too. But doing this part here. So here we're saying I would like to set the local host address and port number of this socket. The call is bind in C, but the arguments, you have to make a struct and fill it in correctly, and that's actually several lines of code. That's the main reason I'm not showing the C stuff. It's not hard, it's just kind of tedious, and there's some utility functions you need, and it's not especially interesting to fill in a struct with, the right numbers that match our local host and local port. So we access our sockets, we create a socket in Python, a socket object, and C, this would be a file descriptor. So represented as a number, in Python it's represented as an object. And we specify an address family, so that's what AS stands for. And the socket type, so which in this case is a datagram socket. And optionally, I could specify a protocol. In this case, I don't need to specify a protocol because the default is that, well, the protocol for datagrams over internet addresses or internet version 6 addresses is UDP. So it just knows that. You know, that's the de facto protocol, so that's the default. So I create a socket, I ask to set its local address and port number. And if I don't want to specify kind of a local port number, a local IP address, because I don't know which of the several IP addresses I want to use, I can specify the special placeholder addresses of all zeros. And that will just match all, be a wildcard for all IP addresses that this machine has. And then in this case, once I have that set up, even though I don't have a remote IP address set, so it's just like defaulting as all remote IP addresses for the socket, I can send something to a remote. I can receive and send stuff. So I use receive from, specify the size I want to receive, I get data, and I get the IP address and port number that I got a datagram from. And I can use send to, and I send a datagram to a particular IP and port number. And both of these functions could potentially fail. In Python, that failure will turn out to be an exception. In C, you'd have to check the return value, and hopefully not forget to check the return value so you know that happens. And also, since this is datagrams, both of these functions, the send to function could not fail. It doesn't mean the other side got your packet. So in this case, I mentioned we have a 5-tuple. In this case, the 5-tuple is going to be the local host, local port, and sort of any IP, and also UDP, local host, local port, any IP, any port, right? Because we have no specified remote port in this case. Questions, this interface. So one thing you might find a little disappointing here is that this is kind of assuming that if the user specifies a local host that isn't just all IP addresses, it assumes you know whether you want IPv4 or IPv6. There's an interface that is going to come up not just for this case, but kind of in general for getting an address, and figuring out not just, the address information, but also whether it's, IPv4 or IPv6, and also handling like name resolution like with DNS. So that's this get adder info function here. So here we pass again a host and a port number. And in this case, I say that my address family is, figure out what type of address. So in this case, it will figure out whether to use IPv4 or IPv6. And we have to specify this passive option. This means this is for receiving, not for sending. That's the primary use is for receiving. We can send from it, but it's primarily you know, the address is being specified for receiving to, we're receiving from to this address. We're not sending to this address. That's what that's specified. And in C, this is more important because the C interface, so in Python, they'll let you specify a DNS name here and they'll figure it out, probably. In the C interface, typically that doesn't work that way. You have to specify an actual IP address in the typical API. And this is a way we could specify either an IP address or as a text string or like a host name that needs to be resolved via DNS. It will do either of those things. And this gives us a list of addresses. And this probably puts people off from these sorts of functions because a reality we have to deal with is that, you know, if I'm asking to like send stuff from www and there are four, you know, my machine has five IP addresses, well, I need to handle all five of them. Probably. So it handles that case, but that can be annoying to code, obviously. Whereas you might just use all the IP addresses wildcard and hope that all of them are www, you know, even though maybe that's not true. So this is for kind of receiving. We can also use the same function for accessing a remote host and remote port, and that's where it's more useful, right? So in this case, remote host, you know, it could be one, or it could be an IPv6 address, and this function will just figure it out, and it will set, you know, AF correctly to either AF INET or AF INET 6, depending on what it is, or we could have like a name and it will figure out, you know, IPv4, IPv6 for that name, and it will give you all the addresses for that name in case one of them doesn't work. And usually the idea is that you'd use this information, you make a socket for the appropriate, you know, IPv4, IPv6, and then you bind to your local address, which maybe is a little tricky in this case because you need to make it vary depending on whether it's IPv4 and IPv6. Maybe you make another call or something. And then you can send to, oh, I should have here the important part. You can set, use the sock adder that you get from that to send to. So that's kind of the generic interface, and this is kind of, if you wanted to have a program that doesn't care about IPv4 versus IPv6, this is how you can do it. Okay. So that's get adder info. So get adder info is our, you know, handles IPv4 and IPv6. It's look up an address, host and port number by name. It handles that operation. And our typical APIs are not intended for that operation. And it returns a list of addresses because there's an unfortunate thing that, you know, one name can have multiple addresses and commonly does. And maybe you only care about the first one, but probably what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to try each of them in case one of them fails. Would be the better thing. But probably a lot of things only try the first one and just give up after that. And I mentioned I would talk about that the sort of, you know, this interface is like the Python one. And let me just show you the reason I'm mostly not going to show you the C interface. So here's our C interface for just IPv4. So we create our socket, we get a file descriptor, and to set up the address to pass to bind, here's the code. So we make a sock adder instruct. It's for IPv6, it's sock adder in 6. I set all the fields to 0. I set the family to AF INET. I set the port number to 12345, but I have to put it in network byte order already. So that's what H2NS does. And I set the sadder field to the IP address encoded as an integer in network byte order. Network byte order being big endian. So H2NS is you know, this is too big endian. That's what those H2 and S and H2 and L functions do. We'll bind. And similarly, when I'm doing receive from, the way I get the addresses is as, you know, I pass a pointer to fill in, and that's how I get the addresses. And for send to, I need to fill in another one of those sock adder instructs and pass it to send the send to function. Okay. So far, you know, it seems like I kind of ignored these destination, address, and port. And that's because I'm using so-called unconnected sockets, that they're just free-floating. They aren't associated with a connection. And in TCP, connections are kind of obvious, right? We have to have this particular stream we're sending to a particular place. In UDP, we don't need to do that. As we've seen, we can just send and receive from various places. But UDP sockets support a notion of a connection. And how I set that up is I can call this connect call, and that sets a remote IP address and port number for my socket. And how that works with UDP is that my packets are going to be filtered by the OS so that any packets intended for a different host and port number, I won't see. And once I do this, this means I can use these functions send and receive rather than send to and receive from. And it will implicitly only go to and from that remote host and port number, because I set that up. Okay, so questions? Yeah.
If you don't do this connection and you have the router forward the port to this machine, does that mean any connection from anywhere can just come and say, oh, I'd like to connect to this socket, and then start sending you data?
So with UDP, you can send to any port. There's no connection operation, right, needed to do that. So what this is shorthand for is that this send is the same as send to with the same remote host and remote port. And this receive this receive is going to filter to only look for something with that remote host and remote port. Does that answer your question?
But if you didn't do that, then...
Then your receive from could get packets from anywhere, yes, if you didn't do that. And sometimes this is a feature you want. So like if you're writing a UDP, if you want to make a DNS server over that works over UDP, you don't want to connect.
Yeah.
That is not something you want to do, because you want to accept UDP requests from lots of places. Okay, so questions? Okay. Okay, and I mentioned we have our sockets. So here you can see, here's some UDP sockets. So here I'm using the netstat command on one of my machines, and this is showing information from the OS about open UDP sockets. And we can see a lot of UDP sockets are not the connected type. So they have their foreign address as this wild card matching any port IP and port number, both the IPv4 version of that and the IPv6 version of that. And sometimes the local address has the IP address be that wild card, so both the IPv4 and IPv6 version of that. Meaning we'll take any of the IP addresses this machine has for those sockets. And sometimes, they specify the specific, in this case, a specific IPv6 address or specific IPv4 addresses. And you can see we have one connected socket here. That's how that's represented. And in the OS, we're tracking this information plus, you know, kind of a pointer to the actual, you know, process. So that's what the OS is tracking. It has this table with pointers to the process and the particular file descriptor. You know, FD number plus process. And when the OS gets a packet coming in, it basically matches it against this table to figure out what to do with it. Okay, so questions? Okay. So we talked about UDP. We also have TCP. So works similarly with two connected UDP sockets. And we use send and receive, but the difference is that rather than send and receive mapping directly to particular numbers of datagrams, or, you know, basically packets, we have, you know, we send and receive, and they're just bytes. And these might get transmitted in multiple packets, depending on how much we send and receive. But it's the same calls before. In C, this is either send or write. So write is the same as send in C. And receive, there's receive, and there's also read is the same as receive in C. In Python, they only provide send and receive as names, so you don't have to worry about that other name. And we can also do this for IPv6. Oh, and as I mentioned in the comment here, we can still bind this. We don't need to. So if we don't bind this, what's going to happen is the OS will choose a host and port for us. Like, we need to have one. TCP doesn't work without one, but the OS will choose it if we don't call bind. The same is actually true with UDP, but UDP sockets are, especially unconnected UDP sockets, are pretty useless without a bind call, because you need to know the host and port. Connected ones you might be able to use. Okay, so questions? And I guess, like with UDP sockets, with TCP, we can have our get adder info, so we can supply a name, and it will give us a list of all the possible addresses. And kind of the canonical way you're supposed to use this is that you like take each one, you try to connect to each one, and if it fails, you try again, and you look for the first one that works. Like, that's what you're supposed to do. And some programs actually do that. Some programs are probably going to just tell you it didn't work if the first one doesn't work. But part of the idea of this is that if we have like five IP addresses in DNS for the same server, this will return all of them. And if one of those machines is down, our program can still work if we follow this pattern. And with TCP, unlike UDP, when we connect, the connect operation, as we'll see, contacts the remote machine. So it will fail if the remote machine is not up. Whereas with UDP, right, we can send to, and there's no like guarantee about how promptly we'll learn that failed. So there's a harder way to do this with UDP. Like, not impossible that you'd have to like have your own logic for, oh, I sent a DNS query and it didn't get there. Maybe I should try the next DNS server. So we showed these send and receive operations, and I mentioned that these don't necessarily split evenly into packets. And this means that, you know, I can send and receive in different chunk sizes. So if I send 5 bytes, I can receive, you know, a 3 and 2 bytes. That is a thing that can happen. Or if I send 5 bytes across 2 send calls, I can receive them in 1 send call. And that's because TCP, as we learned, works in bytes. It doesn't work in packets. The other thing is that because TCP, you know, even though we're sending and receiving in bytes, we can have what are called, we can have sort of partial sends and receives. So I can send, you know, 6,000 bytes, and well, when that gets sent over IP, we know that a typical IP packet size on the internet is like 1,500 bytes. So if we receive for that, we might, sometimes we might get the whole thing all at once, but sometimes what might happen is we might ask for 6,000 bytes and we'll only get the first packet's worth. And maybe then we ask for, we can try again and we'll get, you know, maybe the next two packets. You know, it just depends on how fast they're getting to our machine. And generally, receive is going to default to waiting until it has something to give you, and then it will give you that. So if you want to receive more than that, you need to actually call it in a loop, basically. Or I think there might be a... No, I guess there... And we can actually have this happen on the other side, on the send side. So we can set a socket as non-blocking, meaning that I want operations to complete, not wait. And if we do that, and we ask to send 6,000 bytes, and let's say, like, we don't have space for the bytes next, we can't send them right away, what might happen is the OS might say, okay, I can't send these right away, I can't buffer these right away, there's no space in the TCP window for them, and no space in my buffers for them, so I'm just going to, rather than like waiting until I can send them, I'm just going to tell you, I sent 1480 bytes of those, with the idea being that you will check that return value and try again later to resend the remaining bytes. And one special case is that a read of 0 bytes, so when receive, if you do sock.receive, you know, something and you get 0, this means end of connection. If no bytes are available, either it will wait or you will get an error. You won't get end of connection. You won't get 0. So one other thing I'll mention briefly is that we've kind of shown that you send and then you receive. And with some protocols, this works great. Like, so with DNS, this works great, right? We send a DNS request, we receive the response. In some scenarios, this doesn't work so great. So like if we're implementing one of the chat protocols, so like IRC Internet Relay Chat is a chat protocol. And in that protocol, you really want to both send and receive things kind of at the same time. Right? You always want to be receiving and you want to be sending. So how do we do that kind of simultaneously, especially if you have a lot to send, right? Where the send might take some time. And this one simple answer is we can use a socket, a single socket for multiple threads. We can have one thread that reads the socket, one thread that writes it. Another option is that there's an interface with functions called select or pull or epull or kq, a whole bunch of interfaces for telling you when you can read or write without successfully. And you combine this with setting that blocking setting to false. So you enable non-blocking I/O. So if you can't send right away, it doesn't like stall your application with these functions where you can make one function call and learn, know, have the function call return and tell you, you can send now or you can receive now, and let you figure out which ones are possible. This is also one way you can handle, what if I have a chat program that connects to 20 different chat servers? Now, this is one way you can write that if you don't want to write a program that has 40 threads. So one thing we should talk about, so we talked about connecting to a TCP server. We didn't talk about running a TCP server. And this is something where sockets do something a little confusing. That there's going to be two types of sockets on the server side. There's going to be a server socket, which is going to have kind of the wildcard port number, and there's going to be a normal socket that doesn't. So we'll make a socket, and we're going to bind it to an address, and we're going to call this listen function. So this is still a socket, and C still has a file descriptor, and we're going to use this to create connection sockets. So we can't call connect on the server side because someone's connecting to us, right? And we don't know who they are in advance, right? So we don't have the thing to pass to connect. So we're going to call this accept function, and each call to accept is going to be matched to a call to connect. And that's going to give us a new socket. So we'll have one socket for accepting new connections, and this will have kind of a, you know, remote IP import of any, and we'll call accept to create a socket which will have a specific remote IP import. And so, you know, this is an example of what that might look like for IPv4. So I set this up to listen to all IP addresses on port 12345, and then I accept a connection and I get my particular connection socket. So we talked about kind of what happens at an application level, but we should talk about like what's going on in the network. What's happening when we call connect with TCP and when we call accept? And there's something called a TCP handshake, where there's a sequence of three packets that are sent before we actually start sending data. And they use this special synchronize flag that indicates the beginning of a connection. And in this, our client and server both choose an initial sequence number, and that kind of verifies that we like actually are talking to each other, this is not old. And also protects against attacks where someone can send a TCP connection without spoof a TCP connection, meaning that they can't, you know, they don't actually have, you know, get packets sent to that IP address, but they can still, you know, predict what they would need to send and like make it look like a TCP connection came from somewhere. But so we have these X and Y selected at random, and they kind of verify this connection. And we can see an example of this. You know, here's our SYN in Wireshark for starting a connection, our SYN, SYNACK, and ACK. And then finally, our packet with actual data afterwards. And Wireshark is showing kind of the sequence numbers relative to the beginning, but you can see that we've actually chosen kind of a random sequence number on both ends to start this connection. And this is what, when the OS receives this, this is what it turns into, allowing your accept call to finish with, you know, based on the address it receives and for this new connection from that first SYN packet. And a question you might have is, gosh, you know, why are we waiting so long to actually send data? Like, what's going on here? Why can't we start sending stuff sooner? You know, like, you know, right here, for example, or right here. Why is there no data being sent initially? And that's a good question, because other protocols do that. So QUIC is a protocol that is commonly used for web servers, for HTTP, supported by browsers and web servers that want to be fast. It's kind of the basis of HTTP 3. And it supports a handshake where they've said, well, we can send, you know, with the initial handshake, we can send some data there. We don't need to wait to send data. And we don't need to therefore wait to send responses. Like, we can send data the whole time in this process. TCP has chosen not to do that, but, you know, if you want to have the fastest possible thing, that's what you should do. And this is a performance issue with TCP that, like, a lot of people try to work around, because it means that we need a full round trip time before we get data. Okay, so another thing is, so we mentioned, like, this TCP thing. So we track, TCP kind of is specified in terms of a state machine here. So basically, for every TCP connection, the OS is going to track which of these states it's in. And we have here, we notate event and action. So for example, if I have a closed socket and I do a passive open, aka a listen, it enters the listen state, and when I receive a SYN packet, I respond with a SYN plus ACK packet and go to the SYN receive state. Then if I receive an ACK packet, I go to the established state. If I receive a second SYN packet, I go to the SYN sent state, well, the state. And similarly, if I start in the closed state and I open a connection, I connect. So this active open means connect. I go to the SYN state state. When I receive a SYN plus ACK, I go to send an ACK and go to the established state. So you can see, like, this is tracking what happens. And you might notice there's something weird going on here with the closed part. You know, some things that look a little strange, right? So most of this is kind of straightforward. We just kind of have to carefully look through our possibilities to make sure we do the expected thing. So what's happening with this close operation? Close. So when someone closes our connection while it's established, so we also have the case where it's closed before we finish establishing it. We're going to ignore that, but that's a corner case that TCP implementation needs to handle. Then we have this close operation, and we send a fin packet and go to fin wait one. If I don't close it, but the other end closes it, I receive a fin packet and I send an acknowledgement of that and go to the close wait state. And then when it actually gets closed locally, I go send a fin packet and go to the last ACK state, and then send an ACK, wait for an ACK and go to the close state. If I'm the one closing first, I send my fin, I wait for an ACK, which is what should usually happen, and go to the fin wait state, then I wait for a fin being sent, go to this time wait state. Or I have some other ways I can end up, depending on the order in which ACKs and fins get sent, but I end up in this time wait state. And that seems a little weird, right? What's going on there? Why aren't we just closed, right? I sent a fin, I got an ACK of that, I got a fin from the other side. Fin means finalize the connection, right? We both agreed to finalize the connection. What's going on here? Why do I have this extra state, extra time wait state? And the issue is that we acknowledge the fin on one end, but not the other. That the way our clothes kind of worked is we had fin right, that someone sent the ACK last, and we don't have verification that that ACK was actually received. That's the problem here. So what might happen is that we might get a fin resent to us because our ACK was actually lost. And we can't really resolve this by sending another acknowledgement because then we have no end of acknowledgements, right? We have that problem with TCP where we needed a timeout eventually. And this happens for the connection closing operation, right? That someone needs to timeout. And so the time wait state is doing that. The time wait state is saying that someone needs to wait just in case something gets resent to handle that. And we want to, you know, keep it around because we don't want that fin packet when it's resent to get confused with something else, right? We want to know it belongs to this old connection. We don't want to accidentally make it close a new connection if we reuse the same port number and IP addresses, which could happen, right? We have making lots of connections. We could reuse the port and IP address. Do that. So that's why we have this weird time wait state. And notice that kind of only sort of the one end of the connection ends up being in this state. The other end gets to the close state, you know, the end that doesn't initiate the close, gets to the close state and doesn't need to wait because it got an acknowledgement. But one end didn't get an acknowledgement, it has to actually close the connect. It has to actually wait around just in case there's an extra copy of that, you know, final packet sent around to make sure it doesn't get associated with the wrong connection. So something that's, you know, not shown here is, like, what do we do if I receive a fin here, right? We actually don't have an action on here. So this state machine is incomplete. And most of the time, the answer to that question is we send a packet with the RST flag to indicate, you know, reset the connection. I don't know what's going on. That's kind of the canonical response. Or you can ignore it. So I have all these states, and this is actually tracked by the OS. So here I'm running netstat with, and we're showing TCP connections, and we can see we have a local, a remote address, and we have the state. And we actually have a whole bunch of things in time wait, and that's pretty common. Because the time wait, if we look at this diagram, it says we wait after 2-segment lifetime. So this is like, you know, tens of seconds. So you can see the OS is tracking a bunch of things that are actually closed, but it needs to keep around, and we have a bunch of established connections. And the OS is responsible for implementing all this state machine logic, including handling the various closing states. Questions about our TCP state machine idea? Yeah.
So if I'm stuck on a state somewhere and I wait a while, like apart from the timeout, if I'm in another state and I'm waiting and I don't get something I expect, is it standard to resend the same thing again? Like, so let's say the connection is in the last ACK, like, and like we're waiting for the last ACK and we never get it, we would resend the fin that we sent the last time.
So question is, if we're in lost stack, we would resend the fin. Yeah. So yeah. So there's not shown is lots of resending logic, okay, of resend cases. So basically, every time we do an action, yeah, we need to potentially resend it. So that's not shown explicitly on this diagram. But this also occurs for sending the sin, right? We actually need to have kind of a loop here for timeout, send another sin, and that's gonna be true here. Timeout, send another ACK, So yeah, we're gonna have a whole bunch of extra kind of little logic here for handling resending things at every step that's not explicitly drawn in the diagram. Does that answer your question? Other questions? That's probably in the future something I should have a slide on, is that, we have to resend the parts of the handshake, all need to be resent, potentially, and everything else needs to be resent. Yeah, so we have a whole bunch of resending logic. So when we do an action, we're actually sending it and setting a timeout in case we don't get it acknowledged for most cases. For the special case of this last act, we can't really do that, or this here, we can't really do some of that for some of them, but for most of the time we're doing that. Okay, so one other thing with sockets is that sometimes you want to do things that aren't obviously set things in our sockets that aren't obviously supported. So there's this idea of socket options. And remember I said that BSD sockets are meant to be very generic. So these socket options take a level, a key, and a value. And there's the socket level for OS level options, and there's also kind of protocol level options. I will mostly talk about the socket level options because those are by far the most used. But this is also how you might do things like set the type terms, the terms of service or flow ID fields and things like that. Is related to these flags. And you can see this example here of setting the SO reuse adder option. And that is a very common option. And I'll show you a limited list of socket options here. So reuse adder is allow binding even if the port's active. A reason you might want to do this is because the time wait state reserves a port number. And this is annoying if I have a server that was running and there's a socket lying around in the time wait state because of a connection getting closed and I want to restart the server. So this says, it's okay, I know there's gonna be some sockets laying around. I'm okay with that. I know there's a risk that there will be a stray packet that messes me up. You can also set the size of buffers and control whether close actually closes, close waits for everything to be sent or just closes right away and you hope the OS handles sending everything in time. One other thing to mention, and I might skip over, we'll see how we think. So one other thing to mention today with sockets to finish up is an efficiency issue. So we talked about that you can send, and we had this idea that we're sending just a bunch of bytes and we don't know how they're divided up into packets. But kind of the logical thing to do with a TCP socket is if I send this, that, when I make the first send call, we should send a packet for that, right? When I make the second one, we should send a packet for that. When I make the third one, we should send a packet for that. And this is kind of very similar to, as we'll see, what web servers might naturally write. And there's a problem with this, that we're sending two, if we do the naive thing here, we're sending two very small TCP packets. And this gets really inefficient if we're doing this all the time. We really want to send full size, maximum size TCP packets. We don't want to send these extra little TCP packets. And so to avoid this, most systems implement something called Nagle's algorithm, where they just delay sending data until they have a full TCP segment, or they wait long enough. So basically, when you call send, if they don't have a full TCP segment to send, they'll wait on Linux around 200 milliseconds before sending anything, with the idea being that if you're going to call send a bunch of times in a row, hopefully they'll collect enough to fill up a full packet. Sometimes you don't want this. So like if you're sending video or audio, if you're sending like audio and you want the audio received right away, this is bad. You know, we're adding an extra 200 milliseconds of latency for you. So you can turn this off with a socket option. But it's done because usually this helps performance a lot, especially in like the very common web server case. That's why it's kind of the default way things work. So that's where I'll finish up today. So next time we'll finish up talking about, we'll talk briefly about doing sockets that handle broadcast. So you mentioned you could do broadcast. We'll mention how that's done in sockets. And then we'll talk about HTTP.